Don't Google it. That won't work. But gracebiblechurch.org gets you to the homepage, and then you click on the link that says Learning, and that'll get you to these lessons if you need one of them. Okay, when we left off in our study last week, the Lord had just been taken captive by the Jewish leadership along with a small army of heavily armed people. It's kind of the worst case of overkill we've ever seen. But at any rate, they took him captive. And what's going to unfold for him over the next number of hours is six different hearings, or trials. If you prefer the word trial, just remember that that's kind of a generous term to use for it, because they weren't that good. But six different hearings or six different trials. Three of them are before the Jewish authorities, and three of them are before the Roman authorities. And those two camps have to join up. They have to marry in this endeavor, because you see, what the Jews want, they can't get without Roman help. The Jews want to kill Jesus, but they don't have the prerogative of capital punishment. They're a subjugated, captive people, and only the Romans had that. Obviously, if the Jews had it, they'd kill the Romans, but they can't. So the Jews have to work up some kind of a partnership with the Romans in order to bring about the death of Jesus. And to do that, the Jews have got to present to the Romans some sort of a threat to the Romans. If Jesus is no threat to the Romans, they don't care about him. The religious differences between the Jewish leadership and Jesus wouldn't matter a whit to them. But if they can present him as a threat to the Roman state, the Romans will execute him, and that's what they want. So the whole plan going forward from the time he's taken captive to the crucifixion is to present some sort of a case against Jesus for which the Romans will execute him. So that's what's going on. But the first of these starts with the Jewish high priest and the three trials there. He appears before Annas, who was the high priest emeritus. And then he appears before Caiaphas, who is the high priest. Then he appears before the whole Sanhedrin. Now, Matthew doesn't give us all of this. Some of this comes from other places. Then he goes to Pilate. Then he goes to Herod. Then he goes back to Pilate. So that's the six steps that he's going to go through now, being taken captive. Let's say about midnight on Thursday. I don't know the exact time frame, but about that. So, verse 57 of Matthew 26. And those who had seized Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were gathered together. Now, just to understand the fallacy of all of this, there's about 21 different illegalities associated with these Jewish trials. 21 different things that make what they're doing to him illegal. And the first one we encounter here, and we're not going to talk about all of them, but first one is that it's at night. They don't meet at night. They don't do any of this stuff at night. That was illegal. Had to be done in the light of day, but they're together at night. And our buddy Peter was following him at a distance. Now, sometimes in the Gospels especially, John is excellent at this. Matthew's no slouch at it either. The physical setting is typical of and representative of the spiritual setting. So when Peter is said to be at a distance from Jesus, that's his spiritual problem as well, isn't it? He's a man who thinks that he can rely on his flesh to do great and wonderful things for Jesus. He ain't going to deny him. He's already said that. He said, these other bums you got here in the room with you, they might, but I'm not going to deny you. And Jesus said, yeah, you are, Peter. In fact, you're going to deny me three times before a certain time occurs. And so here he comes at a distance. He's not really what you call in fellowship with the Lord. He's not uptight with him. He's at a distance. And he's as far as the courtyard of the high priest, and he entered in and sat down with the officers to see the outcome. Well, why does he need to actually observe this proceeding to know what the outcome is going to be? Jesus told him what the outcome was going to be. On four different occasions, he told the disciples that he had to go up to Jerusalem. He would be tortured and persecuted by the chief priests and killed, but that he would rise again on the third day. So the outcome is he's going to be killed. He's also going to rise on the third day. So Peter knows the outcome. He just isn't accepting it. So he's following along to watch the proceedings, even though he's been told on several different occasions that Jesus is going to die as a result of all this. Now, the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain false testimony against Jesus. Now, this is a high quality, high morality group here, isn't it? They're just trying to frame him. False testimony is what they're trying to get. They want some bold-faced liar to step up there and say something about Jesus that will make him a threat to the Romans, and they'll try to use that against him. And so they ain't looking for the truth. They're just trying to frame him in order that they might put him to death. That's what they're fishing for, is some kind of an accusation that the Romans can take action for. But they didn't find any. Even though many false witnesses came forward, they had a bunch of guys they could parade by him and make some kind of a ridiculous statement, but it didn't amount to anything, nothing they could really use. Later on, they get two guys to come forward, and the best they could come up with this. This man stated, "I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days." Well, is that exactly what he said? Well, the words may have said something to that effect, but the meaning was that his body, if they destroy his body, he would rise again on the third day. That's what he was talking about. He wasn't talking about tearing down the Roman temple, the Jewish temple, which at this point in time had been about 42 years in building. He wasn't going to tear that down in 3 days. But they used the words against him. So the high priest stood up and said to him, "Do you make no answer? What is it that these men are testifying against you?" Remember, Isaiah 53 speaks of him as a lamb led to the slaughter who didn't utter a word in his own defense. So Jesus is fulfilling that chapter, that verse, Isaiah 53:7. Jesus kept silent. And the high priest said to him, "I adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you are the Christ, the Son of God." So what they're trying to get him to admit openly and publicly is that he is the Son of God and could therefore possibly be a threat to the Romans. Jesus said to him, "You have said it yourself. Nevertheless, I tell you hereafter, you shall see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven." So the next time they're going to see him after these proceedings take place is Revelation chapter 19. Remember what comes back there? The sign of heaven is that somehow or another the sky is opened and the world will see Jesus coming back to this planet. He's on a white horse and we're with him. And somehow or another the whole world can see this. I don't know how that is since we live on a ball. Because if he comes down from the north, the people in the southern hemisphere, you would say, well, they can't see him. So I don't know exactly how that will work. I know you can bend light. Maybe that's what the God will do, is he'll just make it so everybody sees it. But the whole world will see him when he comes back. And that's what he refers to there in verse 64. So then the high priest tore his robes. That's an indication of angst. He's just beside himself. So he tears his robe and says, "He has blasphemed. What further need do we have of witnesses?" Yeah, who needs a witness? We got what we want from him. He has publicly stated now he is the Son of God, and they call that blasphemy because they say he's not the Son of God. But of course, it is not blasphemy. He is the Son of God. "So behold, now you have heard the blasphemy. What do you think? What's the judgment here?" And they answered and said, "He is deserving of death." Now that is really all they wanted from him in the first place. This whole thing is a sham. They're just looking for some statement on his part, some admission on his part that they can use to say that Jesus is worthy of death. And blasphemy, they say, is worthy of death, that is to the Jewish authorities. And then here we go with some real fine human behavior. They spat in his face and beat him with their fists, and others slapped him. And they said, well, prophesy to us, you Christ. Who is the one who hit you? The reason that question makes sense is he's blindfolded. See, Matthew doesn't point that out, but one of the other gospel authors does. He's wearing a blindfold, and so people are hitting him and then challenging him to say who it was who hit him since he's blindfolded. That's the behavior that we're witnessing here. Now, unfortunately, when we get into this detail of the crucifixion, it's kind of like a bipolar event to us. On the one hand, we see the horribly ugly behavior of depraved human beings. And it's hard to read, it's hard to watch, it's hard to imagine treating another human being the way these people treated our Savior. And on the other side of that bipolar event, of course, is the graciousness of God at work, the lovingness of God the Father at work, providing this sacrifice on our behalf to save and redeem mankind from that kind of behavior. The very behavior that's being displayed toward him is what he is trying to save mankind from: depravity. And apart from that new birth, apart from his saving work on our behalf, this is what we'd all be like: spitting on a man who has done nothing, hitting him, mocking him. It's just a terrible sequence of events to have to read and have to realize is what we are all capable of apart from God's saving grace. So it starts right away with the Jewish leadership. So Peter was sitting outside the courtyard, and a certain servant girl came to him. Now, on the ladder of social standing in Jewish society, a servant girl would be about the bottom rung. She would be the least important, the least influential, the most easily blown off member of Jewish society would be a servant girl. And the first person that encounters Peter accuses him of being with Jesus. She says in verse 69, you too were with him in the garden. And Peter denied it before them all, saying, I don't know what you're talking about. Big number one. Remember what Jesus said about him? Not only would he deny him, but he would deny him three times. The first denial is prompted by the most insignificant, easy-to-ignore member of Jewish society, a servant girl. And yet, here we have it already. But that's just the first one. When he'd gone out of the gateway, another servant girl saw him and said to those who were there, this man was with Jesus of Nazareth. And again, he denied it with an oath this time. I don't know the man. Now, remember, the setting was Jesus was at a distance, verse 58. He's at such a distance now that he denies even knowing Jesus. Peter bears the rap when all the disciples, in effect, would have done the same thing. But it really, unfortunately, illustrates in sad detail the failure of man to be able to accomplish anything spiritual on his own. And Peter can't even so much as, he could have said, well, yeah, I know him, but I wasn't with him. But he says, I don't even know the guy. His distancing of himself from Jesus now is pretty complete when you say you don't even know him, isn't it? That's denial number two. And a little later, bystanders came up and said to Peter, "Surely you too are one of them, for the way you talk gives you away." Galileans all had an accent. That's how they know Peter was a Galilean. He's speaking with a Galilean accent. It would be like a New York accent that you just can't miss. The Boyds and the Goyles and that nonsense, you know. So they spot him because of that and accuse him the third time of being one of Jesus' followers. And he began to curse and swear, "I do not know the man." So he adds even more authentication to his denial by cursing and swearing. And after he denied him the third time there, a cock crowed. We talked a little bit about what that could mean. It may not be a reference to a rooster. Maybe a reference to the Roman trumpeters who sounded the shift change every 3 hours. And the third one, which would make this about 3 a.m, is actually called a cock crow. So that may be what it is. That may be why you think, well, where'd a rooster get in the middle of all this proceedings when they didn't want any chickens in Jerusalem for the reason they're unclean? So that's probably a reference to the Roman time frame signifying 3 a.m. So after that happened, after he hears that trumpet, let's say, or the rooster, if that's what it was, Peter remembered the word which Jesus had said, "Before a cock crows, you will deny me 3 times. And he went out and wept bitterly. I don't know how much lower a man could probably have gotten than what Peter got at this particular time. His self-esteem is totally gone. He's a miserable failure as a disciple, as much as one could be. One implied denial would be bad enough. It would crush you. He's got 3 very specific, well-stated, outgoing denials to people that don't make a flip in Jewish society. And as I say, he is the best example that we have in Scripture of the failure of the human flesh to be able to accomplish anything of spiritual value. And Jesus told him later on, or he told him prior to this, it was actually earlier than this, he said, "Apart from me, you can do nothing," talking about the vine and how we're branches in the vine. And boy, Peter really illustrates that well, doesn't he? So he is lower than a snake. He could walk under a snake wearing a top hat. He's so low. So he needs some help, doesn't he? He needs some psyche repair real bad. Now, it appears that the Lord did that when he was resurrected. We don't have the detail. It wasn't given to us, but we know he met Peter. That's mentioned in Scripture, so we know that's a fact. So when he was resurrected, he did meet Peter and talk to him, and I suspect it was to keep Peter from sinking any lower than he already was and just kind of start picking him back up. And it worked, because Peter turns out to be a very substantial contributor to the Church of Jesus Christ. As much, perhaps, as Paul. Maybe not quite as much, but pretty doggone close. So Peter turned out to be a very strong proponent of Christendom. But boy, his start point was pretty low, wasn't it? He was really, really beat down as a result of these 3 denials. It would have been a little less hard on him if he just kept his mouth shut when Jesus said, "You're going to deny me," and not made such a big deal out of the fact that, "No, I ain't. I'm not going to deny you. You know, let me pop a few buttons off of my chest here talking about how great and wonderful I am." If he just kept his mouth shut, he'd still taken the beating, but it wouldn't have been maybe quite so bad. But he didn't. So there's the fulfillment of that prophecy which had been made just a little bit before. But thank God for his grace and his forgiveness and his ability to make something out of nothing. And Peter is a good example of that, and we are all examples of it as well. So chapter 27, When morning had come, the chief priests and the elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. This looks like they got the Sanhedrin council together here now, which would be the third of the Jewish hearings. And they're seeking counsel how to put him to death. That's all they're interested in. No interest whatsoever in the truth. No interest in who he was. No interest in God's message to mankind through him. Just get this guy killed. That's all we want. So they bound him and led him away and delivered him up to Pilate, the governor. Why? Well, because they have to get the Romans involved now to kill him. They can't execute him. So Judas, who had betrayed him, saw that he had been condemned. He felt remorse and returned the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and elders, saying, "Well, I have sinned by betraying innocent blood." And they say, "What do we care? That's your problem. See to that yourself." Now, it's interesting that Judas does experience some form of remorse here. Apparently, things have gotten a little further out of hand than he thought they would. He sees Jesus on a path to execution here. Is it too chilly for you all in here? A little chilly? Turn it up a little bit. And I guess he didn't think things would get quite to that point. Maybe he just thought that Jesus would be discredited, he would be humiliated, he would be sort of dismissed by the Jewish people if indeed he went through a trial like this or a hearing like this and was condemned. And that would be kind of the end of him, and his movement and his following would kind of get dissolved away, and that would be good. That's all he maybe wanted. But what appears to be happening here now has gone beyond that. They're taking him to the Romans to try to get him executed. And so Judas has some remorse in his role in this. And he tried to kind of undo it by going back to the priest with whom he'd made the deal to be a witness for the prosecution. And they think they don't need him anymore. They think they're on a path to getting Jesus executed, so they tell Judas to get lost. So he takes those 30 pieces of silver, which was the price of an adult slave, and he left and went and hanged himself. He threw the pieces of silver into the sanctuary first, so he just throws that money in there. And then he went and hanged himself. He went and committed suicide. Now the scriptures talk about him falling and his body literally bursting open, so it looks like perhaps the hanging tree is over the edge of a cliff or something, and he hangs himself, and perhaps a branch broke or something broke, and he fell down that cliff and literally died that disgusting death of being busted open. So his end is unfortunately kind of symbolic of all men who reject the Savior. So he can't undo what he had done. He throws the money away, and the chief priest took that money and said, "Well, it's not lawful to put them into the temple treasury since it's the price of blood. Hey, we can't use this money and just put it in the treasury because it's going to be associated with the death of Jesus, the price of blood. And so we got to be careful here. We got to be very scrupulous to make sure we don't break any Jewish laws. Even though we're railroading an innocent man to death, we don't care about that. We just can't use this money for the wrong thing." So they counseled together and with the money bought the potter's field as a burial place for strangers. Now the potter's field would be a place where potters would go and dig up their clay, so you would have the start of a bunch of holes in the ground already, the start of a bunch of graves. So they just used that field as a place to bury the indigent. People that had no money, couldn't afford a tomb or a good place of burial, they'd bury them in this field where half the graves were already dug from guys digging up clay. So that's what they do with the money. They buy that field. And for this reason, that field has been called the Field of Blood to this day. So that's where Judas's original 30 pieces of silver ended up, is buying that field where people can be buried. So then that which was spoken through Jeremiah the prophet was fulfilled, saying, and they took 30 pieces of silver, the price of the one whose price had been set by the sons of Israel, and they gave them for the potter's field as the Lord directed me. So that's a fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. Zechariah chapter 11, 12, and 13 is also a reference to the same sort of thing. So even in his death, he's fulfilling numerous messianic prophecies, and this is just one of them. So Judas's end is, I don't know, if can we find a more tragic life than Judas? I'm hard-pressed to come up with somebody that would be as tragic as him. 3 years and maybe a month or two in the presence of Christ, hearing the message from his lips, seeing all of the miracles, seeing all of the gracious, loving, caring acts that Jesus committed on behalf of mankind, and ended up like he does. I can't think of a more tragic life. Now, many lives are going to be lost, of course, and many people didn't believe Jesus, but this guy was with him for 3 years, every day for 3 years, seeing and hearing firsthand himself the claims of Jesus, the proof of those claims. It's just hard to imagine anybody missing the boat so badly as Judas did. Anybody else you think could be a candidate for the worst, most tragic life ever lived? I don't know. Seems to me like maybe he's kind of number one on the list there of tragedies. So that's the way he ended up. So now Jesus stood before the governor, and the governor questioned him, saying, are you the king of the Jews? Now see, if Jesus admits something to the Roman official, that he is some sort of a threat to the Romans, that's what the Jews wanted. So the governor, they must have said something to him, in effect, this guy claims to be king of the Jews, so check him out. So he does, he asks him, he says, are you the king of the Jews? He's saying, in effect, are you some kind of a threat to us Romans? And Jesus said, it is as you say. He is the king of the Jews. Now, he didn't say he was a threat to the Romans. That's what they're going to assume. He just said he was the king of the Jews. And while he was being accused by the chief priests and elders, he made no answer. So he doesn't defend himself. He knows the whole proceeding is stacked against him. There's nothing about this that is fair and just. It's a frame job from the beginning. And that bothers Pilate, that he's not pleading for his life or begging for mercy or something like that. So Pilate says to him, did you not hear how many things they testify against you? And he did not answer him with regard to even a single charge, so that the governor was quite amazed. So Pilate has come somewhat perplexed. This man is not defending himself at all. He doesn't have to defend himself before human governments. This is the Son of God. But Pilate doesn't know that, for well, he just can't quite understand. Well, why is he not saying something in his defense? So he thinks, well, maybe I can get out of this stinking mess by using this tradition that we have established here, which is at the feast, the governor was accustomed to release for the multitude any one prisoner whom they wanted. The Romans would, at one of the Jewish feasts, Passover in this particular case, they would, as a gesture of goodwill, they'd release one of the Jewish prisoners. And so Pilate is saying, okay, maybe they'll let me release this guy and dismiss his case, and I can get out of all of this without having to actually make a pronouncement. So they were holding at that time a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. Now Barabbas was he would be number one on the FBI list of public offenders, you know, the most wanted criminal around. He would be the number one guy. And so he says, therefore they were gathered together. Pilate said to them, who do you want me to release for you, Barabbas or Jesus who is called Christ? So he says he's going to compare the worst offender that the Jews have in prison with Jesus, thinking, well, they won't want Barabbas released. He's a murdering scumbag. They don't want him back in their midst. So they'll accept me releasing Jesus instead of this heinous prisoner they have there. So that's his offer. And he knew, verse 18, that they had delivered him up from envy. He knew he was being used and manipulated by the Jewish leadership. So this is his attempt to try to tap dance out of this mess and get Jesus released, because he didn't really have anything to work with there. And while he was sitting at the judgment seat, his wife sent to him saying, have nothing to do with that righteous man, for last night I suffered greatly in a dream because of him. So his wife had actually been forewarned in a dream that Jesus was indeed who he said he was, a righteous man, the Son of God. And she warns her husband, don't do anything to that guy, because I've had a dream about him and you're messing with a righteous man. But the chief priests and the elders, the Jewish leadership, persuaded the multitudes to ask for Barabbas and to put Jesus to death. So his plan didn't work, because the chief priests and the elders, they whipped up the Jewish population to say, give us Barabbas, release Barabbas and kill Jesus. He thought it would be the other way around. So the Jewish leadership, directly responsible for the crowd's reaction here. And so he says, well, what shall I do with Jesus then? And they said, well, let him be crucified. The population, again, I think primarily because of the manipulation and lathering up of the Jewish leadership, chose Jesus to be crucified. And Pilate's response, well, what evil has he done? But they kept shouting all the more, saying, let him be crucified. So it's at this point in time, it's pretty much a mob. It's not just a crowd. It's a mob that the Jewish leadership has manipulated. And so when Pilate saw that he was accomplishing nothing, but rather that a riot was starting, so he knows that attempt to adjudicate Jesus' case by releasing him, that ain't going to work. The crowd's not going to let him get away with that. So when he sees that he's about to get a riot on his hands, he took water and washed his hands in front of the multitude, saying, I am innocent of this man's blood. See to that yourselves. So he kind of just dismisses any responsibility toward the matter. I mean, this is the proper venue to hear Jesus' case, and the proper authority, the proper Roman authority, just basically says, I'm out of here. And he makes this gesture of washing his hands in front of him, like, I got no responsibility for this thing. I'm washing my hands of this case. He's the right guy. He should have made the right decision. He is another example of failed leadership in the extreme. Governmental authority, dismissing himself from his own responsibility, and handing the decision over to a mob. Pilate's life was not as big a failure as Judas's, but his life was definitely a failure. And he's not innocent of that man's blood. He is responsible for that man's blood. He is the proper Roman authority. He is the proper executor of governmental authority, and he has abdicated his responsibility altogether. And all the people answered and said, his blood be on us and on our children. Well, that's a bad mistake. They're willing to accept responsibility for Jesus' death, and that responsibility extend on to succeeding generations, their children, on down the line for what they're about to do here. And remember in Romans chapter 11, Paul talks about God putting he calls it a stupor in that Romans chapter 11. It's kind of like a spiritual brain fog. Anybody have any trouble with brain fog when you got your first COVID shot?
No.
That was kind of common. I had a little deal for about a minute or two when I had my first one. I think it was kind of like that, where you don't know what the heck is going on. You're kind of just fogged out. That's what's happened to the Jewish nation as a result of divine judgment because of their rejection of Messiah. He's put a spiritual fog on them. And Romans 11 talks about that, and there it's called a stupor. Now, the same thing is talked about in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 that will be put on people during the tribulation period. They won't be able to believe the truth because they've rejected it already, and there it's called a deluding influence. Your thoughts are diluted. You can't believe the truth. You just can't believe it. It doesn't ring true. It isn't logical to you or whatever. Here it's just called, or in Romans 11, in referring to the Jewish people, it's called a stupor. And that's what happened to them here as a result of this. They said, let his blood be on us and our children. And it is on down to this day. So that was a horrible, horrible mistake by the Jewish nation. So he releases Barabbas for them and had Jesus scourged. Now, we get a little more detail in the other Gospels. Apparently, this scourging was another attempt by Pilate to present Jesus in such a pathetic, sympathetic manner that the Jewish people would cut him some slack. They'd release him. They'd accept his dismissal, his release, because he was beat up so badly and tortured so badly that they'd let him go. So they did that. They take him over to the Roman garrison there, and they stripped him down and beat him up, and they made a crown of thorns, as you recall. The Romans would keep some barrels of these thorns. These were these 5 and 6 inch long jobbies, not the little rosebush type thorns. These are big dudes. And he braided all that into some kind of a wreath-like crown and put it on his head. Well, you can't put something like that on your head without stabbing your scalp all over the place with thorns. And then they would beat him in the head with sticks and just drive that thing even further into his head. So that was a terrible, torturous thing. Scourged him. People could die from scourging if you didn't stop it soon enough. That cat of nine tails would eat up your flesh. It had bones or metal chips at the end of leather cords, so when they hit you with it, it was like hitting you with a small knife blade stabbing you in the back. That would eat you up. So they beat him with that, beat that crown into his head, beat his face up so badly that Isaiah tells us that he was not recognizable. How many blows to your face can you take before you don't look like you normally do you? Dislocate your jaw, break your jawbone, break your nose. I mean, all kinds of things can happen to your appearance if people are beating on you as they were, so that he wasn't even recognized after that. And all of that was designed, I think, to try to conjure up on the part of the Jewish people a sense of sympathy. But they weren't even satisfied with that. Their thirst for blood was not satisfied. They wanted his death, and that's all. So none of that worked. Now what happened is that Pilate sent him over to Herod. Herod was the governor of Galilee. Remember, Jesus was a Galilean. So Pilate hears that Herod is in town for the feast, he says, well, wait a minute. I'm going to send this guy over to Herod. Maybe Herod will take responsibility for his case, and he'll adjudicate it. So he sends him over to Herod. Herod talks to him and sends him back. So that didn't work for Pilate either. So he's come a full circle. He came back to Pilate after this beating and after this humiliating experience here, and that didn't work either. So the three Roman hearings was Pilate, Herod, back to Pilate, and this is where he's at here now. Yeah, go ahead, Pam.
Later, they'll try to battle God, you know, to come up against God. It's much the same, is it not?
Yeah, it's, well, what Pam's referring to there is in Revelation chapter 19, when the Lord comes back, the armies that are lined up in Israel to battle each other, they join together and they try to battle Jesus. Now, how stupid is that? What are they going to do to him? This is God coming back. And they're going to shoot him with a rifle? It's just insanity that's seen in Revelation 19. The behavior of mankind here is no different. It's insane. It's so hateful and brutal and degenerate that it's hard to get a grasp on from our perspective. And as I say, to beat up a man that is bound, blindfolded, who's offering no resistance, and these professional Roman soldiers take some kind of delight in beating up a guy like that? I mean, how depraved can we get? Now, these guys' behavior is as horrible as we can find anywhere in Scripture. It is the most unjust happening that has ever happened. The treatment of the Son of God, our Creator, our Savior, our Good Shepherd, our Provider, the treatment of Him by mankind in this particular sentence here is just beyond the ability to grasp. Unbelief can produce the most absurd behavior imaginable. And you see the same thing in Revelation 19 when armies think they can fight the returning Christ, this glorified returning Christ coming back there. And they think they can fight him and, in effect, defeat him and the armies of heaven that come back with him, of which we will be. So, yeah, I think Pam is probably a similar type display of insanity there as what we see here. Well, I tell you what, why don't we knock off here? Got a few more things going on here at the crucifixion, and we don't want to rush through those. So we'll throttle back here this morning. Any questions or comments that you all have of anything you're seeing here? If you find yourself struggling with understanding it, don't be concerned. It is hard to understand the brutality that we, mankind, displayed toward our Savior. If he had had a history of offensive behavior, if he had done something to the Jewish society to harm it in some way, to hurt it in some way, to take from it for his own personal gain some sort of worldly riches or wealth or something of that sort, if there had been any kind of a reason to hate this man, it would be a little easier to understand than what it is. This man never hurt anybody. This was the mildest, most self-controlled, meekest man you could find. All he did was heal the sick, give sight to the blind, hearing to the deaf, raised a few people even from the dead. He never turned away anybody who came to him for help. He never spoke a word that was not absolutely true. He invited all men to come to him. There's no justifiable reason whatsoever for this behavior other than human depravity and the hatred for this man that resulted from that depravity. And apart from his finished work, which we'll see next week and talk a little bit about next week, we'd all be just like these people. This is how we would all behave. Depraved, absolute total depravity. And this is the kind of thing that awaits the world, I think, during the tribulation period when the Spirit of God is not restraining sin. The church is gone. The Spirit of God is not restraining sin like he does now. This is what the society of man will look like on a regular basis, I fear. And we won't be here during the tribulation period, but somebody will be. And that's what they'll be contending with. Absolute, utter depravity. It just, as I say, it's a bipolar type study to see the actions of men in contrast with the actions of God is about as bipolar as you can get. And that's what we get, though, every time we go through the crucifixion narrative. Any questions or comments about anything? We'll go ahead and knock off, and Pat, you're welcome to join us anytime you want to. We're usually here. We usually got a few more folks with us, but won't have too many more. I'm very sorry to hear about Martha. I don't like hearing that word hospice associated with anybody I know. So we may not see her again then, but hopefully we'll see our other members that are out this morning, and we'll join together again next Sunday and have at it again for a little while. So you all have a good week, and we'll see you then. You bet.